Well, we're back for our second in a series of conversations based on the book, Landmarks, Turning Points on Your Journey Toward God, released by B&H Publishing back in March of this year. My name is Bill Dalveau, and as the author of the book, I hope today's 30-minute conversation encourages you, intrigues you, and even challenges you in your own journey with God. Joining me again from the first conversation is Daniel, my good friend, who was actually the first to hear about the idea of the landmarks several years ago. And along with Daniel, we have another man who is also a close friend to both of us. Ed, thanks for being here in the studio with us here today. And thanks for both for being willing to talk about your stories. It's really good to have you here.
It's good to be here, man.
Thank you.
Let me say up front, it's just crucial that we learn to tell our stories and that we learn to listen well to the stories of others. That's one of the main reasons why we're actually recording these conversations, not only to tell our stories, but for others to listen in. For just in the telling and the listening, there can be some wonderful healing and transformation. In fact, I've really come to believe that God uses our storytelling and our honesty here to change us in ways that we didn't even think possible. And I know that's certainly been my experience. As for the book Landmarks itself, it describes 9 different landmarks we all have to pass on our journey to follow Jesus in this life. Now, the first landmark story focused on how we all disconnect at some level from the great story God is telling and try to write the script for our own lives. This second landmark, Idols, now zeroes in on all the props, all the baggage we carry with us into these self-constructed narratives. And that's going to be the focus of our conversation today. So what do I mean by idols? Real simple. Idols are God's substitutes. They are the things we lean on for control, security, and pain relief instead of trusting God. In our age, we like to call them addictions, but the basic idea is the same. And to sort of give a little more meat to the bones, here's a quote just from the book to sort of describe idols. The universal appeal of idolatry lies in the mirage it presents. Idols enchant us with the illusion that we can maintain control and manage pain. Here's our dilemma at present. We can't see God or touch Him. Worse yet, we can't control Him. To rely on Him to be our life, our provision, our happiness appears too unpredictable, so it seems perfectly reasonable to turn to idols. And that's kind of where we want to start our conversation. The Bible tells us that we're all idolaters, and you friends here, Ed and Daniel, the three of us, we can certainly attest to the truth of that. So let's start the conversation by talking about idols in our own lives. And I think the way I want to frame it is this to begin the conversation. Let's talk about a few idols in our lives that sort of kind of pop up when we think about this definition of idols, and then sort of the story of how it became an idol. So who wants to start us off?
I'll start us off. Probably the most powerful and potentially the most destructive idol in my life started at a young age when I took my first alcoholic drink. I started drinking later than most of the other kids in my class. And I did that for what I thought was mainly moral reasons.
Yeah.
And I was managing pain and stress and social awkwardness in other ways. Unfortunately, when I did take that first drink of Budweiser, I figured out that was an easy, quick, and cool way, as a high schooler might put it, to begin to kill the pain and to quiet those fearful voices in my head. It numbed me up to the point where I felt like I was navigating, you know, adolescence in a way that in my brain at the time was really, really slick and sharp.
Right.
I felt like I was maneuvering, and it was a situational thing. You could use it and get to it to get you through painful, awkward, or fearful moments.
So was it almost like a social lubricant for you? Like it sort of
it started that way. I felt like, particularly with girls, that it was something that I could maybe be a little less awkward and a little less I was afraid of girls, and I didn't know what to say, and alcohol was an easy
identify, because I wasn't afraid, I was terrified.
So yeah, I get that. Yeah. I saw other guys being able to relate to women, yeah, or to girls, yeah, at the time, and I didn't have that gift, and I felt like alcohol did that for me. But it was all just a charade, you know. It started out pretty innocently, but it got worse and worse.
Yeah. So this was it sort of a weekend sort of thing that became more and more regular for you, or was it more in terms of like how much you drank that it became worse and worse?
Both. But it started out as a weekend thing, yeah, kind of a party scenario, yeah, kind of thing. Yeah. But then when I moved into college, yeah, it was, you know, I found that I needed it more and more for social situations and coping situations, mainly just to a lot of the time, just to quiet the voices in my head, yeah, that were telling me, you know, you don't measure up, you're not going to be able to handle this. The stress of school, you know, it was a good reason to get good and drunk. And that's the reason it came more and more frequent, yeah, and more, you know, just sheer volume.
Right, right.
And so there were a lot of different fearful situations that it became very appropriate, I thought, for me to use alcohol to just, you know, make the voices stop,
wow,
bugging,
wow,
me.
Wow.
And it worked, you know, very effective.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
It works so well. So do you remember like thinking the voices are coming, I can hear them, so it's time to drink? I mean, was it that kind of equation consciously for you?
Yeah, it was. It was at night particularly. You know, I didn't want to go to bed with those voices.
Wow.
And so, you know, when you're younger, at least for me, I felt like I slept better. Of course, I wasn't, but I used it to make me relax, so that the fear that I had for all sorts of different scenarios, it felt like it wasn't there anymore.
Right.
At least,
right,
I wasn't thinking about it.
Right.
And that's the numbing up part.
Right, right.
You know, I'm functioning on one level, but parts of my brain, it seemed, were not bugging me,
right,
to the point where,
right,
the next morning, you know, I was still fearful. And that's what it felt like it did for me.
Yeah. Wow. And this wasn't just fear of rejection, but this was sort of, did this have to do with fear of failure in school also?
And absolutely,
or fear, yeah,
academic pressures, still at the time in college, girls,
yeah,
feeling awkward with my peers, awkward with sports teammates, and that's, you know, alcohol is just,
wow,
you know, a very big part of that as well. So you know, it seemed like every scenario that
it started working really well.
if you're looking at in college, those,
yeah,
are the big,
oh,
ones.
Yeah.
And you know, it became ingrained every point where I felt like I had time to drink, or before social events, or after athletic events,
yeah,
or after studying, or after a big set of exams. That was the time, and that's when I needed it to get up and then get down. So,
wow, that's great language for that, kind of that progression of starting and then kind of moving through all that. So,
mm-hmm,
yeah, thanks, Ed. Daniel, why don't you jump in here?
What's
your story with an idol?
Well, as I get started with my story, let me just say one. Honestly, I thought I would be farther along in my life,
man,
at 38 with my victory over idols when I was younger. I thought I'd be
I'm
farther
kind
along.
Kind of reach this.
Yeah. I thought in a lot of ways my idols still can haunt me. There's definitely been a lot of growth and a lot of ways that I feel like God has kind of met me in these places, and I'll share in a little bit about a story about that. But I would say, I just want to preface it by just the acknowledgement that I'm not idol free. You know, I'm aware of their pull still.
I'm so glad you said that. It makes me feel like I'm okay.
Oh, well, good. I thought maybe I was the only one. So
no.
That's good. Sheesh. You know, I think my idols fit two broad categories of they seem to provide affirmation and comfort. So if I think literally of every idol I've ever had in my life, I could put them in those two.
That's the theme.
Those are the themes
of your idols. Just like yours was numbing out fear, Ed. Mm-hmm. This is almost like this is your theme.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're made, for me, they were made so subconsciously. Didn't even realize what I was doing with them. And a lot of them were legitimate in and of themselves, but they became things that I used. So, for instance, I played basketball when I was in high school and middle school and high school, and I was where I was at school in that era. I was seen as an athlete, and I got a lot of affirmation from that and enjoyed that experience. And so, without even realizing it, how many points I scored in a game, who was watching, what people said after the game, the day after, if my name was in the paper, all that stuff kind of became something that I looked to for affirmation. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, it really worked.
It works well.
It did work well.
That's the problem. Just like Ed and the alcohol, it works really well.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly
right.
It
works so well.
Working eventually.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Usually when my knees started going out. But early on, that was one. You know, there were others, and I shared last week about part of my story was just the pressure to always kind of be spiritually deep and significant, mm-hmm. and kind of on and
right.
carry everyone else's burden and be this intentional, deep young man. And, you know, it was, and I kind of was that, but so an idol that kind of, it's kind of like when Ed talks about going to class and then you get to the end of the day and it's like, oh, I got to find a way to comfort, relieve the stress from that. For me, it was sexual lust.
Yeah.
That at times included pornography. And it was just this little kind of a place where I could go and not have to be deep not have to be significant and powerful. And
which is exhausting. That feels exhausting.
That's right. And it seemed to be kind of my little Garden of Eden where I could just go and rest, you know? And then food is another place in the sense of comfort. Where, you know, when I was young, I could eat so much food and I was just skinny because I was just always so active. And I don't even know when it happened, but it became a place of comfort for me.
Sure. You can call it comfort food.
Comfort food. I mean, there are whole, it's interesting. C.S. Lewis, in his talk about sexual brokenness, said if we went to a planet where people went to strip clubs that were full of pork chops and bacon, we would all think there's something really messed up with this culture and their idea of food. And I think of all the cooking shows that I love to watch. That's right. It's like, what is up with me and the rest of the world? But after I'd been out of high school for a while and I'd lost a few steps on the basketball court, one night this is in the first year of my marriage, and I was in my late 20s. I had had some physical health issues earlier in life, and just a lot of things contributed to where I wasn't as good as I'd used to be, just age. And my marriage was, you know, there's some things in that were, you know, I was trying to wade through, and kind of some difficult some challenges there. And but there was this church down the street that had this basketball court, and one night a week a bunch of guys would show up and we'd play pickup basketball. And how I played in a what seems now just such a stupid, foolish, trivial experience, but for me, I literally left feeling either like a man or like a complete failure and a child based on how many shots I made. And that's not an exaggeration. So one night I remember, and so again, it's validation. If I can score more points than you, then I'm a man. If I miss this shot that in my mind should have made, then I'm not a man.
Right.
All that, you know, everything was a test.
Right.
So this one night I came home and had not played well and just felt so low because my idol had failed me, and just felt like life literally was almost not worth living, which I know probably sounds extreme, but that is how it felt. And so I got home, and you've heard the story, Bill. I've shared this with you before. But I got home, and well, on the way home, went to Wendy's. You know, had the double with cheese with all the fixings and the fries and the frosty. So I wasn't hungry when I got home for food, but I was, my soul was still starving.
Yeah.
And so I remember I sat there, I was watching TV, my wife was in the other room, and I made about a 2-pound plate of nachos and ate them all. Wow. And to me, and you know, of course then felt not only like a failure on the court, but I felt sick to my stomach and disgusted. And again, my idols were failing, but to me, man, I was so hungry for what neither basketball or food could give me.
Right.
But right. That story played itself out hundreds of times.
That's that's a great picture. That's a great little open window into how all idols work. Yeah. You know, and my, you know, I, like I said, I've had my stint in pornography and when I was younger, and then got hooked to just sort of, everything has to be in order. And that's the way I handled my internal messiness in life was my clothes were, my shirts were lined up by color. I mean, that's how just like,
it's compulsive. It's amazing we're friends, to be totally honest.
Compulsive. I was just so compulsive. So everything had to be in order. If it didn't, it's just like, I just felt like this anxiety. And I look upon that now and I just go, what was that all about? It was just, it was just my way of comforting myself rather than trying to go in and look at all the messiness inside. But the one that really, you know, hooked me for a long time was really an acceptable idol, which it's so hard, you know, like the alcohol, pornography, things people get into that are corrupting and destructive. You can just sort of go, I need to get off of that. But for me, it was this tandem sort of back and forth with food and exercise. And it was a little bit different than your experience with food, although there are a lot of similarities for comfort. But for me, I was struggling for many years with chronic depression and didn't know what to do with that. And I felt, you know, from my story last week, I was telling about just, I've got to figure out life on my own and all of those sorts of things. And I felt so disconnected from people. And so what I would do to handle that is I found, you know, I ran track in high school, and in college I just started running again. And I don't even remember when it happened, but somehow in my 20s, I got this idea, if I ran more, I could eat more. And when I ate more, I didn't really have to connect to people. Hmm. I could just sort of like be in my own little, like, you know, just sort of thing of just eating. And of course, if you look at me, you go, I'm skinny. I'm still skinny. And it's like, how did I do that? Well, the answer is I kept exercising more. And then it became every day. It's like I had to do it. It's like your whole schedule revolved around, when am I going to get my run in? And of course, running came natural to me. That sort of, in some sense, fed it all because I could do pretty well at it. And that sort of cycle of running and eating and, you know, running more and eating more, that continued for many, many years. And it was, I just sort of played it off or excused it as like, well, exercise is good for you. You know, and then I would eat these enormous amounts of food. It's like, well, I got to get ready for the next day. But actually what I was saying was, I ate all this food. Now I got to go back and really exercise tomorrow. So, you know, and Dan, you said this, I love your language. I don't know if I had an eating disorder, but I certainly had disordered eating. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not. And, you know, this whole thing was just the way I managed depression. And, of course, exercise helps with depression. But it's the way I managed it without actually looking at the causes of why I was so depressed. And that carried me literally into the ministry. I was doing this even as a minister and even long into my stint as teaching and coaching. So it was a real one that really hooked me for a long time. Let's talk just a bit about how the idols were a replacement for God. Like what does the Lord as our Father offer us if somehow these idols seem to offer better?
Hmm. Well, for me, starting from a very young age, I always associated drinking with having fun. And, you know, God enjoys you having fun.
Right.
It's not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
And when I had girlfriends and when I met my future wife, we associated having alcohol with everything that we did. having fun. And so they went hand in hand, having fun, drinking. And I found after a while that the two were inseparable. I felt like I couldn't have fun. And to a degree, I still feel that way.
Because it's so ingrained in you.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
It is. And of course, that's not the truth.
Right.
And it kind of dovetails into my relationship or how God looks at me as a child of God. I was unable to separate the two. And so therefore, you know, I don't know. I feel like that I got into a deep, deep rut and a pit with that association. Mm. I felt like that it really was something that God had me locked into that spot.
I mean, into that pit.
Into the pit,
right.
Of that association.
Yeah.
I think I was afraid not to drink for fear that I wouldn't have fun, that God wouldn't allow me to have fun in any scenario unless I used alcohol.
Right. And you know, it's interesting because underneath all idols are a lie. There's something that's driving it. And again, you put great words to that. That was the lie.
Right.
You know? And I think about the scriptures and just, you know, the joy of the Lord is our strength. You know, what is that about? And sort of that overflowing sense of, you know, with true joy, there's always that sense of playfulness, you know? And so how that got all kind of mixed up in your mind.
I really don't think that I believed that God would allow me to have true joy without that and other idols as well.
Yes.
But particularly that one because of that just twisted association that I had.
Yeah. Hmm. I've already talked about, you know, the running thing was for me, you know, that was my kind of comfort. That was the way I sort of managed pain in my own life and the pain of depression and disconnection. So, I look back on it now, it was just so almost subconscious. Like I didn't even realize I was doing it.
Yeah.
But it just worked so well. It just, you know, kind of kept me going. And, but it would, you know, look up on it now, it's like, yeah, that really was substituting what the Lord had for me, something so much better. What about you, Daniel?
Well, I, again, thinking in the categories of both affirmation and comfort, you know, going back to my story with the basketball and then the nachos, I, you know, with the basketball, it, on the drive home after not playing well, it never once occurred to me to invite God's presence into that emptiness. Not one time. And I just couldn't stay there. Or at least it didn't seem like
so I had to have something.
I had to do something in my control, trying to control that emptiness, right? So the God, I never gave God a chance to say anything to me about my manhood in those moments. And it didn't even occur to me, frankly, that I was bringing that question into the basketball game before the night began. But I was.
Yeah.
I just didn't have ears to really hear what God would say to me about who I really was. So every, you know, basketball was a test of that. And then just so, you know, and then so I needed to comfort myself, so I thought. Because God wasn't going to do it, and that didn't even occur to me. And, of course, I was a youth pastor and worship leader at the time. So God was certainly a part of my life in those categories, and I could have maybe even given this talk back then, frankly, because I knew I had the ideas, but in the moment, all of that seemed absent, and I just went to what I could control, which was a false comforter, to numb myself from what I couldn't control, which was this emptiness, because I didn't have ears to hear what God would say.
Let's talk about how the process of disentangling ourselves from these idols, like what have you had to do, and then what has the Lord had to do. And I'll just say real quickly, because I want y'all to kind of finish the conversation today. One of the ways the Lord got me out of the whole running trap was I came to a point where I developed minor hip arthritis. And it's like I either was going to stop running or I was going to have a hip replacement. And so that physical trigger was one of the Lord's really pulling me out of that. I couldn't get out of it on my own. And it was that was really helped exercise. Of course, I still exercise today. Become something that's like, well, I like it, but I don't have to have it. And I literally had to be pulled out. It had to be cut off of me. So I wanted to share that quickly because sometimes we do our part, but I mean, God has to come in sometimes and just do the part we can't do. So who wants to talk about extricating themselves?
I can start with that one. I feel very blessed and thankful to say today that it's been, Monday was 9 months since I've had a drink of alcohol. So
it's great, man.
Thank you. I really look back and know that it was not in my strength that that began or is happening or will continue to happen. That much, that's about as clear cut as I can put it. And I know that that's one truth in this recovery process.
Right.
So I feel very blessed and thankful for that. I think it really began as a desire that God put in my heart to be a better father and a better husband. So many times, exhaustion and irritability and just checking out for my duties that God put me here to lead my family. I was just negligent or so irritable that my performance, if you can use that word, performing the duties of a husband and a father, and as a business owner, frankly, I was just negligent in all three of those categories.
Yeah, sometimes it's almost like we have to see the damage we inflict on other people before we come. That has to stop.
Yeah.
It's not just the damage on ourselves. It's what it does to everybody around us. Is I think for many men, kind of the point where you go, I have to get out.
Absolutely. That is so true. And I remember thinking so many times, I don't want to leave this legacy for my children.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I do not want to make the mistakes that my forefathers have made. I felt my heart the way that it was when I was drinking, when I was younger, and when I was drinking, now, recently, and I did not want my children to feel that pain. I didn't want to leave that in their minds when I'm dead and gone, that this was the way my father was. This was the way my father left a hole in my heart.
Yeah.
And so God put that in my heart to hopefully begin that recovery process.
That's great. Thanks, dude. Danny, what about you? We just have a couple minutes.
Okay. For me, a story that comes to mind, since I can't play basketball, one of the ways that I enjoy competition is with tournament fishing. And there was a tournament a few years ago that I had entered, and again, bringing my question, am I really a man, without knowing it, to this tournament. And the boat and the truck that I had at the time were old and run down. And as we're getting ready to launch that day, I'm in between other competitors with the latest and greatest, and I
immediately felt the security level drops.
I felt like a whole lot of me was just shrinking, and I thought to myself, well, I'll show them, I'll go out fishing, you know. And I went out, and to make a very long story short, was just having a terrible day fishing and lost some big fish. And it was about an hour before the tournament ended that day. It was a two-day event, and I remember I was so angry and felt so much shame. And I think it was just God who helped me realize I'm believing terrible things about Him, because I thought, you know, if you really love me, Lord, you'd let me catch a fish, as silly as that is. And then I thought, if I was really a man, I would catch a fish. And I thought, I'm on a boat that I own, pulled by a truck that I own, doing my favorite hobby, and I'm miserable. And what is wrong with this picture? And so you talk in your book, Bill, about the choice to let go, but then we need God to do some other work. But so for me, the choice, and I remember the prayer, it was all silent, but I said, God, I am going to choose to believe that you love me if I don't catch another fish ever in my life. I wish I could say that has always held true, but that was a true heartfelt prayer. And I really was willing for that to be the case at the time. And then God, interestingly, within about 10 minutes, I caught a good fish. And I know it's just a fish and I know it's just a silly tournament, but it felt like God took my face in his hands and kissed me. And he said, now you're ready for this gift because you don't have to have it.
Right.
And I don't finish the story with this as a formula that if you pray this, God will do that. But interestingly, the next day...
That's the mystery, though. We don't know.
It is the mystery. But interestingly, the next day, my partner and I caught 83 fish the second day. And it just felt like God said, cast your nets on the other side of the boat. You know?
Well, watch what I do.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, and I'll end on this note. I think when we allow God to begin to fill those holes, it's a superabundance. It is a superabundance. Guys, thank you so much for being here on this conversation. Thanks to all y'all for listening in. And we'll be doing this again for the third landmark entitled Wounds. And I hope you'll join us for that then. Goodbye for now.